Quick poll, quick show of hands. Does anyone in here actually like taking tests? Okay, my Enneagram 3s out there, you overachievers. Everything in life is a test to prove you are the master of everything. I was talking to a 3 recently and they said they were winning at therapy. It's like, I didn't know it was a game. If so, I'm losing really badly. I like knowing things. I don't really love tests. I'm a slow reader, so I bombed the reading portion of the SAT. Just not enough time. It's like 5 giant stories you have to read and comprehend it and then answer all these questions in 25 minutes. I struggled. Generally, nobody likes tests. According to a 2010 study, test anxiety can affect anywhere between 10 to 40% of all students. But whether you like them or not, they're inevitable. You take tests to prove you're knowledgeable about something or to show that you're qualified for a position maybe you're applying for or to show that you're qualified to drive a vehicle. Maybe some of you might need to do that test again. Generally speaking, tests are not bad in and of themselves. We understand their function, and in some sense, they're necessary. However, it gets really uncomfortable when we see all throughout the scriptures, it's pretty unavoidable. God tests humans a lot. For example, Job was a test. God allowed the adversary in the book of Job to torment him. He lost everything, and God did the test to prove that Job would be faithful. Genesis 2 was a test. You can eat from any tree in the garden except this one. This one is off limits. And they were tested. They were given a choice. Our passage here is a test. It says that God literally brought Israel through the wilderness and then led them back to where Pharaoh was like, they're lost. Let's go get them. And he positions them to be landlocked between the sea that they would drown in or Pharaoh's, like, tank chariots. They're tested. It's a recurring pattern here in the biblical story for how God relates to his chosen ones, because that can then be really problematic for us. Are we just lab rats? Are we just lab rats in some, like, divine experiment? Like, this feels like a problem. This feels really cruel. Is this really who God is, that we're just disposable pieces on a chess mat? Like, nobody really cares about the pawn, right? You just sacrifice it. Is that who we are to God? Disposable lab rats in some sick game to prove some divine point? Or is there something else going on? Is there something much richer, much deeper as to why God tests humans? Well, let's find out. Exodus 13, I'm going to back us up just a little bit. Exodus 13, verse 17. So when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, well, if they face war, they might change their minds and return back to Egypt. And so God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. And the Israelites went up out of Egypt ready for battle. And Moses, he took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the Israelites swear an oath. He had said, God will surely come to your aid, and you must carry my bones up with you from this place. So I want to cover just a few kind of important things before we get into the sea crossing. Exodus 13 and onward is Israel's journey from Egypt. They have been oppressed by Egypt for hundreds of years, and God has now commissioned Moses to take his people out from Egypt. There was a whole thing with plagues. If you missed that, you can go back to that. But now here they are. And Yahweh says, they are a fearful people. And I don't want them to get entangled in war, or they might just bail and head back to Egypt. So what he's going to do is he's going to not take them north, but due east through the wilderness, through the Sinai Peninsula. So we have a fun little connection here to Exodus 1 in these verses right here. And this is a good example of literary patterning. Welcome to Lit Class. Because what I just read is the same wording in this passage is used here in Exodus 1 to show that Pharaoh was afraid this would actually happen. Let's go back to Exodus 1:9. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, let's deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So Pharaoh in Exodus 1 is like, okay, I've got an idea. Let's enslave them. Then what happens? Ironically, his enslavement of the Israelites led to the very things that he was afraid would happen. War against him from Yahweh. The people multiplied and they left Egypt. His evil and his foolishness led to a self-fulfilling prophecy. What he was afraid of exactly happened because of his own fault. But more than making Pharaoh look foolish, he's good at doing that himself. The narrator is showing us a few intentional connections here that I'll show you in a bit. Verse 19, "Moses then took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the Israelites swear an oath. And he said, 'God will surely come to your aid. And then you must carry my bones up with you out of this place.'" If you have read Genesis, at the very end of that book, Joseph tells his brothers that God will bring them up out of Egypt, and they are to take his bones with them to bury him in the land promised. Genesis 50, "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land, to the land he promised an oath to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob.' And Joseph made the Israelites swear an oath and said, 'God will surely come to your aid. You must carry my bones up out of this place.'" So when we read stuff like this, it's like, what is happening? This is really random, but there's connections here to make a point. The repetition of all of this wording, we've kind of got a rebooting here with Exodus. There's a new movement now in the narrative, so we're kind of beginning anew. This is what should have happened if Egypt did not oppress the Israelites. And so this is a creative way that the author is showing us that God is making good on his promises. No matter how much the enemy tries to mess with it, he's making good. He's promised hundreds of years ago that he would make a people and give them the land, and here we are. This is happening. And one other connection I think is important to make before we get into the sea crossing is in verse 18. So God led the people around by the desert toward the Red Sea. I'm going to break your brain here a little bit, okay? This is not what the Hebrew translates to. What we know as the Red Sea in the Hebrew phrase is the Hebrew phrase Yam Suf. Can you say that? So Yam Suf literally means Sea of Reeds, not Red Sea. How did that happen? Well, there's a very long and interesting debate out there that I'm not going to get into. It is fascinating, and I could go down a rabbit trail, but I'm not. I'm going to try and keep this really brief. Some scholars think it became Red Sea because of cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. So, for example, like the Black Sea is north and the Red Sea is south. Some languages even use words, like color words, to refer to cardinal directions. Also, both gulfs. I think I have a picture of this. Yes, so if you can see that, the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba, they are both in the scriptures known as Yam Suf. Yam Suf is also a generic way to refer to a body of water. So why the heck is all of this important? As I see it, okay, just track with me here. I believe the lack of specificity is on purpose here. Not because this like didn't happen. I don't believe that. This Exodus did happen. Hear that. But I believe, or I see it, that exact coordinates on a map were not the highest priority here. The highest priority was to highlight that God is making good on his promises, to connect this story to another story that we have already read before about God delivering an Israelite through a sea of reeds. Do we remember this? Exodus 2, the deliverance of Moses. I've got a picture that we've used before. I did not draw this, but it's really good. So remember, at the very beginning of the story, Exodus 1, we've got a Pharaoh, and then God delivers him through Moses through the Sea of Reeds, and then he takes him to Mount Sinai where he meets God's presence. And then right here, we've got another Pharaoh that God is going to deliver now the Israelites through the Sea of Reeds. Do you see that? Moses' story and the Israelites' story are parallel stories. The infant Moses, whose mother placed him among the reeds, whose name means one who draws out. Just as Moses passed through the reeds to escape death, so the Israelites would pass through the reeds to escape death. By the one whose name means one draws out. Oh, also led by a pillar of cloud and fire, that it says Moses met that pillar of cloud and fire. Y'all, it's too good. All of this parallelistic structure by the author is to reveal a few key themes, and we've talked about this. God hears the cries of people and promises to rescue them. He promises to confront evil with justice. God desires and plans to dwell among his people. And he's faithful, even when we are faithless. It's really cool stuff. He's making good on his promises, no matter how much the enemy is trying to mess with it. Let's move on. Exodus 14, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near that place between Migdol and the sea." Karin, you did a great job translating that. So I'm not going to do it. "They are to camp by the sea directly opposite of Baal Zephon. And Pharaoh will think the Israelites are just wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart. He will pursue them, but I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all of his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." So the Israelites did this. And when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, and Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, "What have we done? We let the Israelites go, and we've lost their services." So Yahweh, he has turn the Israelites back and encamp them by the sea. And this tip gets back to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's like, "Those dumb Israelites, they're lost. Why did we let them go? Let's go and get our labor force back." And so the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, was not the knockout punch. In fact, in verse 5 here, it says he changed his mind. Literally, that translates to his heart was changed inside of him. His heart turned over. This is the same wording that's used in Jonah when it says what will happen to Nineveh, except for them, their heart turned over towards Yahweh, but for Pharaoh, it was the opposite. It was a complete turn away from God. That should haunt you. So he pursues them. 600 chariots, verse 10, as Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. And they were terrified. And they cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt you brought us out here in the desert to die? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone. Let us serve the Egyptians. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die out here in the desert. Snarky. But before you throw some shade at the Israelites, what would you have done? Or said? Well, I'll tell you the exact same thing, because every time we go back to our sin masters, rather than follow the way of Yahweh, we are saying we would rather be in Egypt than trust the way of God. We are the Israelites. And following Jesus feels like this, a choice between two deaths. Death by our sin masters, who just lull us into separation from God now and forever, or death through self-denial, picking up our cross and following him. But look at what Moses says. I love this. Verse 13. He answered the people, "Don't be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance that the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. Stand here and watch the salvation of Yahweh." You want to know what that word in Hebrew is? Yeshua. Jesus' name. Stand here and watch the Yeshua of Yahweh. Jesus. Here's your choice, Israel. Here's your test. Will you go back to your sin masters, or will you trust in the Yeshua of Yahweh? What seems like certain death is actually your salvation. So for the next 3 to 4 minutes, I want to do something just a little different. I've not done this before, so this could bomb. I don't know. But I just want to read the rest of Exodus 14 as one unit to give you kind of a backdrop and then make a few connections from it. So lean in. We good? Yeah. Great. Verse 15. And then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch it out. Stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after him. And I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all of his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." And then the angel of God, who had been traveling in front of Israel's army, withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front of them and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to one side, but light to the other. So neither went near the other all night long. And then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And all that night, the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. And the waters divided. And the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots and horsemen. They followed them into the sea. And during the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud of the Egyptian army, and he threw it into confusion. He jammed the wheels of their chariots so that they had difficulty driving, and the Egyptians said, "Let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." But then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians." And Moses stretched out his hand. And at daybreak, the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, and the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea, not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through on dry ground. with a wall of water on the right and the left. And that day the Lord saved them. And they saw the Egyptians laying dead on the shore. And when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and they put their trust in him. So if you notice, there is a lot of repetition here. There's a lot of repetition here. And I just want to key in on some of the wording and language that's used in this salvation narrative because it's intentional. Here's just a few examples, okay? The words split and divide and also dry ground, they are used in Exodus 14, 16. Raise your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. That same language that's used here is also used in the flood narrative with Noah. And it's also used to explain how the earth and the waters receded to expose dry land in Genesis 1. So in both the flood narrative and Genesis 1, this language here is used. And in verse 21, it says, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind, and it turned it into dry land. That word there for wind is ruach. It's the same word used to describe the Holy Spirit, like the Spirit of God hovering over the waters in Genesis 1. So God sent his wind to create dry land for his chosen ones. Are you seeing this? But we also have a dividing here between Israel and Egypt. Verse 19, the pillar of cloud moved from in front and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. So what all of this does here, lean in, what all of this does is this is cluing us in that this is going to be a decreation and a recreation. Israel and Egypt are being divided. One will be decreated, but the other is going to be recreated. He is recreating Israel by passing them through the chaos waters, salvation. Guys, it's the same image for baptism. From death to life through the chaos waters, but the same act of deliverance for Israel becomes the same act of judgment for the Egyptians. Instead of being delivered through chaos like the Israelites, chaos is brought down on Egypt. First, with God confusing their camp, verse 24, during the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud, and he threw it into confusion. So he jammed their wheels and their chariots, and they had difficulty driving. That word for confusion, it is spelled with the same letters of the Hebrew word tahom. Can you say that? Tahom means chaos waters. The Tahom of Genesis 1, Egypt and Pharaoh are being decreated from order to chaos. And that image is really important because this is what's happening. Egypt is being given over to their evil. That's Romans 1. And God just gives them over to their evil. But Israel is given a choice. Will they trust Yahweh and his word? And we know they do. They're brought through the chaos waters. And this image is important because Yahweh is bringing life out of death. Yahweh is creating a way out of no way. He is creating hope out of a hopeless situation to show that he can be trusted. I asked you in the beginning, why does God test humans? Why does God test Israel? Why did he bring them back to be caught between death by Egypt or death by the sea? And while the word test doesn't activate a lot of positive thoughts for us, it is unavoidable because it is how God relates to his chosen ones. When God selects someone as his representative, he gives them the opportunity and blessing, abundance and responsibility, and all of those opportunities become a test. Will they trust God's word and his wisdom, or will they do what's good in their own eyes? So caught between death and death, their only option is to just stand there and die, but because they are waiting, they are saved. Out of death, he creates a way for life. The Yeshua of Yahweh. The path to life is trust in God and what he says is true and right. And what he says leads to life, not what you say. As I see it, this is the main point of the passage. Why does God test us? He tests his chosen ones to see if they will choose him, his way, his wisdom, or their own way and their own wisdom. Even in the story of Jesus, the New Testament writers saw what he was doing as a test. Both the scene of him in the wilderness with the devil and the Garden of Gethsemane before he's arrested are both described as tests. Matthew 4:1, then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tested by the devil. Matthew 26, right before he prays to his Father, he tells his disciples, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. That same word is test. Same word used for the wilderness. We know Jesus passes the test, both in the wilderness testing and the Garden of Gethsemane, because he trusts the Father's plan and his word. Not my will, but yours be done. And so God's testing leads to a choice. The choice is believing and following your way, your own definition of good and evil, or it's following God's wisdom, his way, his definition of good and evil. The choice between death by Egypt, our sin masters, or death by the way of Jesus. That's the choice. But that life comes out of death, resurrection life. But before all that, there is a death. So I just want to riff on this for just a little bit more. The call of Jesus is a call to come and die. I've read this before, but the cross is laid on every Christian. The first Christ suffering, which every man must experience, is the call to abandon the attachments of this world. It is that dying of the old man, which is the result of his encounter with Christ. As we embark upon discipleship and we surrender ourselves to Christ in union with his death, we give over our lives to death. And thus it begins. The cross is not the terrible end to an otherwise God-fearing and happy life, but it meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. Bonhoeffer, if you know his story, was later murdered by the Nazis for his resistance to Hitler. His radical counterformation in the way of Jesus led to his death. So for Bonhoeffer, it's a literal death. For a lot of saints in history, it's a literal death. But for all of us, it is some form of death. It's unavoidable. Because apprenticeship to Jesus is a call to self-denial in an age where everybody is saying, do what you want. A realization, we are not the means of our own salvation. No, at the center of a discipleship is a cross. And Jesus says, do you want that? Are you sure? Because it's a call to come and die. Saying no to yourself and yes to Jesus sounds ridiculous because most of us cannot fathom a vision of the good life that does not involve getting what we want. But there's really only two options here for Jesus. It is death by sin or death to self. And listen, I know we talk a lot about the cost of discipleship to Jesus, but we need to talk about the cost of non-discipleship to him as well. Meaning it will cost us so much more not to follow him. It's your soul or it's yourself. And when you do the math, you may conclude that yes, following Jesus will cost you a lot, but here's the thing, not following him will cost you so much more. It will cost you life with God, the purpose you were created for. It will cost you access to him, peace that transcends all understanding, joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. It will cost you freedom from bondage of sin, healing from the wounding of sin, forgiveness from guilt and shame, and adoption into the family of God. Are you willing to trade that for short-term happiness? Just do the math. How much is your soul worth it to you? Jesus is not saying, come live by faith. We all do that. We all trust someone or something to lead us to the life that we ache for. The question isn't, do you live by faith? It is, who or what do you put your faith in? Do you trust him? Not just for your eternity, but for your daily life decisions too. See, Israel is caught between death and death. Death by Egypt, or following God into death that led to life. I'm not sure what you need to die to, but I know it's something. Because the invitation of Jesus is to simply come, follow him into death, but in doing so, you discover life. The Yeshua of Yahweh. God is my salvation. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me, because whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. So stand. I just want you to simply meditate on the following before we go to the table. Again, I don't know what you need to die to, but where does Jesus not have all of you? Is it your credit card? Is it your job? Maybe a sexual ethic? Where does Jesus not have all of you? Because I know it feels like one is death by Egypt coming at you and death by waters, but I promise you death by your sin masters is worse. Where is he inviting you even now to come and trust in his wisdom, in his way?